Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where the hustle does sometimes sleep.
Washed Radio.
And if you're new to the show or been around a while and haven't done it, be sure to join our free email list where you'll receive access to working money tips, interesting reads, and much more. You'll also receive our free 15-minute money plan as a welcome gift. Visit paybell.co/email to sign up. Again, that's paybell.co/email.
Yes, and also we've been quietly working in the background on a new website. So if you go to paychecksandbalances.com now, you'll see our fresh new look. Shout out to @StephenAHart for the great work he did helping us refresh the whole brand. This process has been a while in the making, so super excited for it to finally be done, man. I feel like it's a come up.
Yeah, I think it's one of many positive moves we'll be making moving into 2019. Gotta get those new goals straight, folks.
And I know there's other stuff that we've talked about that we have not forgotten that will be coming soon. Day job, side hustle, a lot, but we're slowly and steadily getting there. So again, shout out to Stephen A. Hart. Be sure to check him out. So who we got on today's show, man?
Sir, we have Kevin L. Matthews II, a number one best-selling author and former financial advisor whom has helped hundreds of individuals plan for their retirement, and by 27 was named one of the top 100 most influential financial advisors by Investopedia. He holds a bachelor's degree in economics from Hampton University. He claims the only HU, a certificate of financial planning from Northwestern University, and a certificate in disruptive strategy from Harvard Business School. He then launched Building Bread in 2010 to inspire millennials to set, simplify, and achieve their financial goals.
Yeah, that HU shot was pretty real, and I expect at least one person to have a comment about that. But yo, this was a fun one, man. So there is like a slight little whistle that appeared throughout and then disappeared because, hey, there seems to always be something. Technology can only control it so much. But a great conversation with Kevin, and we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you.
So we're going to jump right into the thick of it, if you will. Let's say a person's organizing their personal finances for the first time. What does that financial planning for beginners conversation look like to you?
Yeah, for that, the beginning conversation is just figuring out what are you looking to do? That's, you know, I would say the first 15 to 20 minutes of any conversation I have with clients, it's like, what are you doing? Or not what are you doing, but where do you want to go? And then we, right. But yeah, I need to know where you're going. That's how we organize it, because organization looks a lot different depending on what you're trying to do.
What are some common misconceptions that people come in with, either about themselves or their money?
I would say one misconception, one big one, is that it has to be static, that you come up with a plan and it works the first time and then you have to stick to it for the rest of your life. Plans are extremely fluid for tons of different reasons. And, you know, one person may have 12 different plans depending on what season it is and, you know, how they feel that day. And that's normal.
Is there any common bad investment advice that you would, you know, like to see die in the E streets and beyond?
Oh my God, yes. There are several. I'll give you the top three that need to die like immediately. Number one, the whole cryptocurrency phase. That I think that one has died off on its own. I need that to die.
What do you mean?
Well, everyone, I was getting investment advice from my barber about how I need to invest in Bitcoin. I did a radio interview in Baltimore. A guy told everyone in Baltimore to put their entire tax refund into Bitcoin because you know it's going up. And that was a quote from him. 3 months later, it dropped like, what was it, 60 or 70%. So that needed to die. Weed stocks are next. I think it's a legitimate industry. But people are throwing money into that. So the whole penny stock realm, that needs to die. Index universal life insurance, that also needs to die. So those are my top three.
So you're sitting in the barber chair, I imagine, and your barber's trying to give you this advice. And you're sitting there like, yo, when you come back at your barber, does he zeke you? Like, how does that work?
Man, it was an awkward conversation. Because it's awkward for me, I'll say, because you don't want to come in like, you know, I'm this advisor. I know what to do, what not to do. So shut up. I didn't want to come off like that. But you know, I'm sitting here like, I'm gonna need you to finish this fade first, and then you and I are gonna have a conversation. It was awkward because not only did I tell him like that's not the smartest thing to do, So I was like, hey, you should look at like, you know, a normal investment like Coca-Cola or Pepsi, you know, something that you're going to be okay. He was like, nah, stocks are too risky. And I'm like, bruh, you're going for Bitcoin when I'm giving you like a legitimate company that's been around for a while. You think Coca-Cola is more risky than Bitcoin? Yeah. So he didn't take my advice. He went ahead and did it. I came back. You know, I go every 2 weeks. So months later, I'm like, hey, you sick of the Bitcoin? Nah, man. You try to tell me. I'm like, well, yeah. So now you're still here. Oh, yeah.
And I mean, maybe it's a simple answer, but I'm gonna go ahead and ask the question anyway. Like, why does this keep happening? I mean, it was homes, it was the tech. Everybody's gonna get rich on tech, and I think only the Mavericks owner did. Now it's weed, it's Bitcoin. Yeah, I think he was like the only one that came out rich at the very end. Like, why do people keep getting caught up in these scams?
Yeah, so I'll shoot for the easy end. There are a few somewhat like mid-tier complex ways. But the big reason is people don't like to see people dumber than them make money. And that was like a paraphrase from Warren Buffett. Like when you start to see, you know, some random guy on the street, like, oh, I made $1,000 on this random stock. Yeah, well, hell, I went to college. I can do that too. And then people just keep piling on to this thing and, you know, end up collapsing at some point. But anytime you see somebody that you know, like, that person is not all together, but I know they made this money, then people just jump into it blindly, don't do any research, don't think about anything, and just do it because they think it's going to be a really quick payday.
Okay, that does make sense. I don't know if it's going to get picked up, but I had to relive the most painful job I had. It was like, what is the most awkward job? And I got caught up, and apparently people still do, in the Vector door-to-door knife.
Cutco.
I really thought I was going to put the industry on his ear. And I look back, I was like, Marcus, you was going to sell knives, weapons of death, door-to-door. You know, mothers and fathers, like, bruh, like, I don't know. It don't make no sense now, but they had me like, you know, y'all like, I paid them to take my money.
Right. And then you see somebody do this whole presentation because they almost got me. They all had a guy, you know, you get the next guy next to you in high school and you sit down in the whole forum or whatever. I'm looking at this guy like, oh, he's real down to earth, simple. If he can do it, I can do it. And then, you know, I looked at everybody else. I'm like, I'll pass. Like, I'm not a salesman. But yeah, like people, you look at the dude that's selling, like, oh, I can do that. And then next thing you know, like, you have $500 and got a house full of knives and nothing to do with them.
Yeah, I made a $2 commission check.
I don't even cook, man. And I've had people pitch me those knives and I'm like, but I'm not really making anything in the kitchen. So what's that about?
You know, it comes full story. They got their hands in my nephew. You know, I'm 36 years old. My nephew is like, yo, man, I'm about to sell these knives. I was like, no.
Don't do it.
I think I tied up in the street. So I think that is actually a good segue here. So as a, and I don't know, I really don't hear about this in other communities. Maybe I'm disconnected, but as a young Black man in the field, do you have any thoughts on, is there any additional factors for Black households that we might need to overcome that are either overlooked or under discussed when it comes to our finances?
Ooh, yes. There are a few. I would say that the biggest ones, and there's some research around this, I think, from Prudential, but we tend to, and I always get in trouble, so I'm not saying that the housing market is bad, but African Americans tend to invest a lot more in their houses and not in the stock market, and that has some very adverse effects. The one reason why, for example, when the crash happened, that was a real estate crash, right?
In 2008?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, that was a real estate crash, which also caused the stock market crash. Well, because most of our investments as Black people was in the real estate market, we still haven't seen a full recovery at all. But those who had a house and a 401k and some stocks on the side, they made their money back like 2010, 2011. So they're fine. They have recovered. We have not, because we decided, you know, we had this notion that, oh, we should have something that's tangible. My house is my best investment. And this is the only thing that really matters. And that wasn't necessarily the case. The other problem is, because we're Black and because redlining is still a thing in 2018, we don't always get the same housing value. So white guy, I don't know, $200,000 home, I pay $200,000, but his is appreciated more just because he's in, quote, the right neighborhood, and mine isn't because they slotted me for a different neighborhood. So even though we had the same money, same job, same credit score, the value of my home does not appreciate the same. Versus if you and I bought Apple or even Bitcoin or something crazy, we're going to get the exact same value if we invested at the exact same time. So that's one of the many issues that, you know, we as African Americans have to plan differently for and explain differently if you're an advisor versus, you know, just an average person that walks in.
And so a lot of people out there are going to know what redlining is, but for those that don't, what does that mean?
Yes, redlining was the history of the housing market starting, I would say, right after World War II. And basically, the government gave cheap housing loans to almost everybody for the most part. What happened was they would draw, literally, banks would draw an outline in red lines where Black neighborhoods were supposed to be and white neighborhoods were supposed to be. If you were Black, you could not move, or they would not grant you a loan to move into a white neighborhood. And if you did, you would A, be threatened, and then B, everyone else's, the white houses on the block would actually lose value too. So they did not want you in your neighborhood for racial reasons and economic reasons. So they slid you to the worst part of the neighborhood. They slid you in areas where it was not advantageous and then also cheaper and also less appreciated as well.
And for anyone that wants like a detailed or more detailed explanation of that, Netflix actually has a show called Explained. I think it's ran by Vox, and they actually go into the wealth gap. So that is actually a really good episode. So if y'all
and it's only
that,
it's only like what, 15, maybe 17 minutes long. So it's quick, but it's a very good explainer.
And a little like 20-minute breakdown. They got a number of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the hesitancy to invest. So how does someone overcome that as far as investing in the stock market or other vehicles than just the home?
Yeah, you just gotta start. Start small. If that's a hesitancy of yours, start small. So there is a trading program called paper trading. You can do that through Investopedia, where you buy actual stocks, but it's not your actual money. It's basically a game, and you get to see what would have happened if I bought X stock on this day and waited 5 months or however long. That's how I started when I was in college. I didn't know how it worked. I just kind of jumped into it and then kind of understood, like, oh, you know, I don't become a millionaire overnight, but, you know, I did make some money because I bought this stock. Or, you know, I bought this stock and it was really terrible. Let me not do this in real life. So that was one way that I understood how the market actually worked. And then obviously it read a lot and kind of took it from there.
So let me also ask this, because I'm sure there's some people who I'm just not going to convince, you or I. Is there any other conservative method that people could invest in where they could just beat inflation? So something they could average about 2-3%?
Yes, there are a few. The question is, like you said, does it beat inflation, which is just the rising cost of stuff, I like to say. But yeah, there are a few. But then is that going to get you to where you want to go? You could go for a CD, just a regular certificate of deposit that you can get at a bank. The longer the CD is, the higher you will get paid on it. So maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you might get paid, you know, 3-5%, which is, I mean, that's decent. You could go for a bond. Those are more difficult to find, but that's another way that you could easily beat inflation with a few advantages there too.
And so there are some folks who've done nothing with investing. I know I got like a money market savings account or whatever else. So you mentioned CDs, and I think we know what that is, but can you define that for the people? And then also for someone who has not thought about investing before, kind of what does that mean? Where does somebody really get started?
Right. I'll start with the last question. What does investing mean and how does one get started? My whole job is to make investing simple and then to show people where to start. That's why my book literally was named Starting Point when I wrote it, I think 2 years after college. And a lot of my materials are base level, how do we start from square one?
Mm-hmm.
But investing for me is making work optional. What can I do right now for the next 10, 15 years to make work optional? Where if I'm going into work, it's just because I feel like it, not because I have to.
Yes.
That's what investing does at the end of the day. I buy either a portion of a company, that would be a stock, or I would buy a business, let's say a Subway, or a home. And these things are paying me so that they're replacing my salary. So that's what investing is at a base level.
And I think you asked a little bit about a CD, a certificate of deposit. How does someone, is there any upper limit on those as well? Like, is that max out? Like, I can't make a certain amount of money. Is anyone able to get a certificate of deposit?
Anyone is able to get a certificate of deposit. And again, a CD is more or less, it's like a restricted savings account. You put your cash into it. You get it from a bank. It is guaranteed up to $250,000 because it's FDIC insured. And at the end of the term, that's when they give you the 5% or whatever percent they are guaranteeing you. But the risk is you cannot, in most cases, you can't break that CD. I mean, once you put it in, that money, you cannot touch it until the end of the term. And then the other caveat or catch, if you will, is depends on what you're getting paid for it. Again, you can find some that are 2%, maybe 3%, but you have to hold it for 2 or 3 years. So not everyone has the capability to do that. I think it's great for, you know, like if you have 1 year CD for a vacation that I'm taking next year or something like that, but that's not something I would do for financial independence for 20 years or something like that. That's not going to be enough to get you there.
Other than a simple savings account, are there any cash or fluid vehicles out there that could still get you that? And I keep going to 2% just trying to keep up with inflation. So I want to minimize my risk. I just want to keep my money and maintain my spending power. Is there any vehicle for that?
More liquid, you could go with the money market. That may help you get there. And then there are a lot of online banks that may help you get there as well. But those are the most liquid that will also get you as close as possible to those.
So for anyone listening who hasn't done anything, we just covered 4 good excuses and then 1 best excuse. So I best of luck to you. I do want to change subjects a little bit, but I think it's because people don't talk about this, and I think it's equally important. And usually people don't, you know, wake up, they're not woke until it's right there in front of them. And that's households not having a discussion about, you know, the family, right? Either holistically, but probably more in depth is really how their parents are going to impact them. So you kind of opened with, so I want to explore this a little bit, that a life index, I think you said a life insurance on an index fund was bad or an investment that you wouldn't advise. Why is that?
So that particular investment vehicle is called an IUL, Index Universal Life Insurance. And it's, the reason it's bad is because it's very complicated for most people to understand. And what they sell you is that you get to make money. If the market goes down, we protect you and you don't lose any money. That sounds great. You get to make money, but then you don't lose it. Perfect. The problem is the cap on the amount of money you can make in most cases is very low. If I invest in a regular index fund and I don't have those protections, I might make somewhere between like 7% to 10% on an average year. Over, you know, every on average for like 10 years, right? So I'm gonna make a decent sum of money if I hold it long enough. An index universal life insurance will A, put me at a cap, let's say 5%. So I'm making less money than I would have if I had put it in the market. And then B, they also charge you an additional 1% to sometimes 3.5%. So in real life, the market goes up, they only cap you at 5 and they charge you a fee. Then you end up only making what you would have made in a CD at 1% or maybe 2%, or a money market at 1% or 2%. So you're paying someone to make less money, and they give you the security, but you're after fees, after taxes, all that kind of stuff, you're really not making that much.
I had a painful flashback when you said paying somebody to lose money there.
It's painful.
Story of my life. Painful. And we also had a great conversation with Broke Millennial, a.k.a. Aaron Lowry, a.k.a. Episode 53 alumni. And you mentioned that you and your wife had actually discussed this before, also in depth before getting married. So her piece was called Are You Your Parents' Retirement Plan? We'll get that in the show notes for you. It's on Forbes. And you said it's difficult on 3 levels, the marriage, the parents, and then the money. Can you explain a little bit how y'all approached that conversation and what you mean there?
We approached the conversation in almost different levels. So here's the issue. I'll lay out the issue for most people. When you get married, there are a lot of things that merge. So not only you know, you and your spouse and the debt, the investments and the plans that you and your spouse have. But then you also merge your parents. And in some cases, if, let's say, four parents, I think five in my case, because it's my mom, stepdad, and my dad. So that's three. And then she has two. If something happens to one of them, let's say parent A passes and now mom is on her own, then she needs to move in. Well, you have to figure out what happens if that's the case. What happens if, you know, we need to move back? What happens if one parent just didn't retire or didn't have those savings? So we had to figure out what are scenarios that we have to cover and how do we discuss those and what do we do now to ensure that that is not a burden on us. And the way this conversation came about is because my grandfather had Alzheimer's, and that was a family ordeal that I did not financially have to deal with, but I had to see my mom and my aunts and uncles figure that situation out. And then on her side, her grandmother is dealing with the exact same issue now. So I'm reliving the entire thing again 6 years later with her grandmother. And the grandpa has already passed. So again, they're figuring out, you know, her aunt had to move back, and then we're doing all this other maneuvering. And we're figuring out, like, look, we've seen this play out two times. What happens when it's our turn? And what can we do to prevent this from being a financially stressful situation, or to prevent it from becoming an even more stressful situation than what it already is?
What does that look like as far as people increasing their financial security? Is it as simple as life insurance, or is there some other vehicles? Are there other vehicles that people aren't thinking of until it's time to think about them?
I would say life insurance is one of them. It is definitely a big one. The only thing is, if someone is sick for an extended period of time, that life insurance isn't going to kick in until the last breath, literally, which is not good, but it is the truth. The other thing is seeing what your parents have now. And that's not always a comfortable conversation either, but it's one that needs to be had. My father and I talk about what properties he has and his pension and stuff all the time. My mother and I talk about how she's going to pay down her parent plus loan and how much debt she has left in my home. The easier these conversations become, and you start with one, you don't open up the whole book, depending on how your parents talk about money, but just one page at a time. Like, how do you have life insurance? How does that work? Do you have any debt that's outstanding? Do you have any assets that are growing for you? And you take it piece by piece and you put all that together and then figure out what the entire situation is and where you may have to fill in. The good thing about that is you understand what's out there, because the last thing you want to do is a parent passes, that's stressful, but then you're also getting hit with additional debts and bills and stuff that you had no idea about. So you don't want to be blindsided by a passing and a financial issue as well.
That was great. I was like, I have no follow-up questions. So we're going to switch a little bit, talk a little bit more about the investment strategy. I know that's what some of the people are here for, but I definitely thought that family conversation would pertain to some. Do you fall on the active or passive side of the investing camp, and why? Why not?
I fall on the actively passive side of it. And actively passive, yes. And that is a thing. And the reason is you don't have to choose. You don't have to always be passive. You don't have to always be active. And the way I set my portfolio up, I have about 80% in passive investments. And for those who don't know, passive investments are index funds where I just own every stock that's out there because it's in my index fund, and I let it sit there and do nothing. And that's exactly how I like it. The other 20% I do have divided into 7 or 8 stocks that I tend to only change those once per year. So that's a part of the active and passive. Like, do I buy and sell stocks? Yes. But do I do it every day? No. I only do it at the end of the year. And that keeps me patient. That keeps me calm. And it keeps me from doing stupid stuff when the market changes like it did the other day or like it did back in February.
And so right now there's all this talk about, like, where the stock market is, it's going down. I got people who I work with who are like, oh my gosh, the sky is falling. And as of the time we're recording this episode, the stock market has gone down over 800 points. So I guess what I'm asking is, when should we panic? Because there's a lot of panicking going on right now.
Never. I'm a panic. Never scared. Like, it's, there's no, ain't nobody got to panic. It's not that serious. And the reason I say that, which people are like, are you crazy? Let's take it like this. In February, the market dropped 1,000 points 2 times, and we're all still here.
Yes.
So that's one thing. The second thing is market pullbacks are supposed to happen, at least generally, every 10 years or so. And a pullback or correction is like 10%. So when the market drops 10%, that's like, this is normal. If it drops 20% in a year, then that's a more serious concern. But when the market dropped, what was it, the 800 points the other day? That was like 2%. That's not worth worrying about. So I always look at it in perspective. And the other problem is like the points, like when it drops X amount of points, like that's a buzzword. It's not really that important, because as the stock market goes up, it's like, I'll put it like this. If I only have $2 and I lose a dollar, like that's 50%, but it's only a dollar, but that's 50% of my money. If I have $100 and I still lose, and I lose $2, that's more points, but I only lost 2%. And that's how the market, because the market has been going up, like the points don't matter as much. It's really the percentage loss or percentage gain that matters more. And that's the reason why they put out 800 points or 1,000 points, because that gets headlines, but 2% is like, oh, okay, it's not a big deal.
And so when the market is doing this, stock rates are going down for various companies. Are you more of a, this is the time to buy more, or I just need to keep everything where it is?
That is a great question. I am someone who tends to buy more, and that's because of my situation. Because I'm still in my 20s, it makes sense for me to do that, because I have more time for that investment to recover and get back to where it's supposed to be. If you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, you might want to stay where you are. And at that point, remember, you have to stay allocated. That's the most important thing any investor can do. 90% of your investment returns are based on your allocation. And that is how much of your money is in stocks versus how much of your money is in cash and bonds. So if I say 70-30, 70% of my money is in the stock market, 30% is in bonds and safer investments. And the older you get, the more you want to have in those safer investments. So right now, because I'm 90-10, this is a time for me to buy more when it tends to dip. If you're, 50 and up, you're closer to retirement, you should be closer to 60-40, maybe 50-50 mix.
And I think you hit on this, but does your advice change for the person planning for retirement versus the day trader? So someone using or investing in a 401k versus someone trying to actively pick stocks?
Yeah, the advice definitely differs. Someone who is day trading, they tend to take on a whole lot more risk. And I have a friend who does well day trading, but most people, and by most, I mean 95%, don't make money day trading. They think they make money, but when you factor in taxes and the fees that they pay to get a stock for X price, they really come out negative over the long term. So they might have a great year this year, but then you look at them 5 years later and they'll look like, in real life, I was really down like 1,000 or whatever. So the advice definitely differs. If you're a long-term investor, most of your money's in your 401k, you're taking the long road, you're not paying as much in taxes, and you're going to be fine. You're active, that's a whole different story. You need to own a lot more stocks. You have to be a lot more diversified, and you have to play it very, very carefully.
This might be a diversion and we can get back on track, but I'm listening and there's a lot of great financial tidbits. But like, how did you even get into this certified financial planning place or space? I don't know why I said place. Like, like what led you here?
I had a long and rough journey. Now I'm playing. my journey, I tend to think my journey is unique though. I graduated from Hampton University, the only and real HU. And
no comment. We're going to hear about that.
That's why I was like, I'm just going to be quiet.
All right, then. That was the correct response. Anyway, after graduating from Hampton, I had a degree in economics. And that I was always interested in personal finance. I started my company Building Bread in my sophomore dorm room. I had never invested at that point. And I went directly for Teach for America. I taught math in Dallas, Texas for 2 years. And from that, I think it was actually the best experience for me, because that experience informed how I teach people about money. It helps me to explain the stock market and other things to people very easily. And that's when, after those 2 years, when I decided, you know, I'm teaching these kids and getting them ready for college, but these kids cannot afford college. And because they don't have a lot of money, which is why they're in this particular school district, which means they're going to get slotted to this particular, you know, system, and it just didn't feel right. So I felt that maybe if I become a financial advisor, I can teach them how to better manage the money they do have, and maybe I can set them on to a different lifestyle. That's when I joined the financial industry. I got my licenses. I did a certified financial planning curriculum test, all that kind of stuff at Northwestern, and became an advisor. So I did that for 3 years, and then I transitioned to a strategy director role at the Office of Financial Empowerment here in New York City.
I always say it's getting started. Just seems to literally quite be that people don't start. But am I missing that? What is the greatest obstacle to people investing or just really managing their money?
For investing, that is the biggest one. It's getting started. And I have a whole 3-day guide at buildingbread.com/3days that will show you how to start investing in just 3 days. But that's the number one question I got. I was like, hey, why haven't you guys started? I just don't know where to start. So that is the hugest, biggest thing. I don't know if hugest is a word, but that's definitely the biggest thing.
Well, let me go ahead and ask, because I'm sure someone is asking in their head right now. Where is that starting point? Is it literally their bank? Is it their employer? Is it all of the above?
It is all of the above, but because that's a lot, I would narrow it and say your employer. That is your biggest asset is if your employer offers it. Not everyone does, but most do. If they have a 401k or a 403b or 40 whatever, start there. It's the easiest thing for you to do because the minute you set it up, it's going to come right out of your check before you notice. You might get a match, and no other investment vehicle does that for you. And then you're going to have the tax benefits as well. So depending on your tax situation, where you live, investing now at your job may help you to be in a more advantageous position when it comes for tax season.
So I think this is going to be the most familiar for people. And so we actually had a great conversation about particularly 401ks and 457s. And it originated from a hashtag AskPB question, hint to the listeners. Any pods or blogs discussing tips on how to address the gap years between when you reach hashtag FIRE, which is financial independence, retire early for folks who are new to the game. But most of your money is in a 401k, a.k.a. you don't know what to do to early withdraw. And you talked a little bit about how to close those gaps to reach that independence. Can you talk about that here?
Yes, definitely. Those who retire early kind of run into that weird situation where you put your money into a vehicle for 401k, for example, but you can't withdraw until 59 and a half. And that's not necessarily early for some people. The people you see like retire like, you know, 35, 40, maybe 50 at the most. So how do you pull up that money before then without getting hit with a huge IRS penalty and an extra taxes? Well, there are some really fancy techniques that you can use. There's a Roth conversion where you can convert some of the money year by year into an account that you can withdraw from.
What's a Roth though? I just want to make sure that we're capturing the basics for people.
Yes. So when it comes to investing, you have different accounts. You can invest in the exact same thing. Don't worry about what you're investing in, but you have different buckets. Every bucket that you put it in has different tax rules. If I'm putting it in a 401k bucket, that is a different rule than a Roth bucket. A Roth means that I am paying taxes up front. When I withdraw, I'm really not paying too much in taxes. When I put it into the 401k bucket, I'm paying zero in taxes now. But the minute I put my hand in the bucket and take it out, that's what I'm going to pull out and pay taxes. So if I pull money out of my 401k bucket right now, let's say I pull out $1,000, I'm really only going to get $800. Because when I put the money in, nobody taxed me. That was pre-tax money. If I pull it out of my Roth, $1,000 out of my Roth, it's going to be $1,000 because I paid taxes the minute I put the money in.
And you also, along those same conversations, although this particular one was for Experian, and we'll get this in the show notes, you talked about the importance of investing in your 20s. just sounds like you're not only preaching, but also practicing. So for that young person who says, you know what, my money ain't right yet. You know, I ain't ready to walk it like I talk it. You know, these boys out here, it's easy for them because they got the, you know, 10 years ahead. It's easy. What would you say is the importance of starting in your 20s and why?
Bruh, if you start in your 20s, it makes everything easier. And for example, if you were to do like the math chart, which I'm not going to get into, you know, if you did like $100 a month now in your 20s, but I started in my 30s, it's going to cost me, let's say, around $300 a month just to catch up to what you did. And the person who starts in their 20s is going to hit that $1 million mark way sooner. They're going to end up having more money at the end of the day at 60 or 70 or whenever they need it, way faster and way cheaper than what it's going to cost me if I did two or three or four times the work. I started investing for my son 2 months ago, and he's 6 months now. So when he was 4 months old, I immediately opened up an account for him and started investing now. And by the time he's 15, 16, 17, if you know the market plays out just normally, it doesn't have to be on fire, he can have, you know, maybe 60 to 70,000 if everything plays out right at 15. You know, I always wondered, and this is something that always got me into, like, what if my parents invested in Apple or Amazon when I was born? Like, dude, do you realize how things would be different? Now, if I invest in Amazon today, I got to wait 20 years, you know, to get that type of payoff. Whereas he could have started when I was born, or they could have started when I was born. I could have been student loan debt free and everything at this point. Right. But I'm trying to give him what I didn't have. And if you're in your 20s, give yourself what you don't have right now. And it starts with stuff that's super, super small. It doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be $100. Like, invest 20. You got 20, invest that. But you are going to thank yourself down the line.
If someone is in their 30s, like us, how does that advice change?
By the way. I'm not that far. Like, I turned 29 in like 2 weeks. So
I hate you. I hate you.
Why? My bad.
Yeah. But so we're 35. Or I think we're both 35, at least as of the time of this recording. I hate you. How does that advice change?
It actually doesn't change that much. It doesn't change that much. People tend to start in their 30s. And it's better if you start in your 20s, but you're not necessarily too far behind by starting in your 30s or mid 30s. The only difference is you might want to try and invest a bit more. And generally, I recommend somewhere between 10 to 15% of your income. If you have not started at all and you're in your 30s, I would definitely up that to as much as you can. Now, I'm not going to lie. Everybody don't have 15% to put in it. But get as close to that number as you can. If you can afford 15, make it hurt and see if you can get to 16 or 17. But you want to try and catch up as much as you can. And that would be from really the age after you graduated college, perhaps 20, maybe 24 to 35. So you want to put in like an extra percent or two to catch up to what you would have had.
Cool, man. And so both of us, I think we ain't got no kids that we know about. So,
which is good.
Yes, which is good. But so my question was going to be to you, like, what's the biggest lesson that you've learned from fatherhood?
Other than kids are expensive. Man, biggest lesson from fatherhood thus far. I think this comes primarily from my wife. But she always says, because she's someone who just loves to write and wants to be an author one day, that she loves motherhood because she gets to write this story for our son. And she gets to decide what characters are going to be in there and decide what's going to be in today's chapter or episode or however you want to do it. And she has everything kind of staged out in that way. For me, fatherhood is the ability to build his future. So I'm putting around a set of circumstances and situations to where when he's my age at 25, 26, 27, 28, where he has all the tools and resources that I'm not going to have until I'm 50. So that's starting to invest for him now. That's setting up a savings account before he was even born and putting him in a position to where, regardless of if he has to take care of me or not, which is a goal to where he doesn't have to, but I want to position him to where a Mark Cuban or, Jeff Bezos, who got like a $100,000 loan from his parents. Like, I want him to have all of those opportunities. The lesson is, do what you can now and give your child, financially, give your child the things that you wish you would have had when you were a kid.
Yeah, it's definitely an excellent response. I feel almost motivated to have kids, but not quite there.
Ski.
I was like, but the opposite end of that is, the more I put in for him, that's the less I got for me. So daycare is expensive. What's like $1,200 a month in New York? So I could be building my own future a lot faster without that expense. But it, you know, it's a give and take. But yeah, I would not rush that expense if I were you.
Well, actually, let me ask this one follow up question. Then, is there anything you wish you had planned for going in with that in mind? Financially, I mean.
I was sitting here like that could be a lot of different things.
I think we planned a lot of it. I don't know if there was anything I wish I had hit the 6-figure mark 5 years ago, and maybe I would have been better off. But yeah, there's only so much you can plan. So we planned for the medical bills. We knew that we had health insurance and all that kind of stuff. We changed our life insurance, did all that kind of stuff in advance. But other than that, financially speaking, it wasn't much more that we could do other than just bear it. I mean, maybe, I guess I would have moved to a cheaper area. I'm in New York now, so maybe I would have back to Texas or something like that. That really might have been the only thing I wish I had done differently. But New York has its advantages, fortunately and unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I spent, I don't know, it was like 4 years in New York City, and that whole experience was crazy for multiple reasons. But you mentioned Texas, so where are you actually from?
I'm actually from Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. So have you seen a tornado?
I'm sorry to hear that.
Don't make me find you.
Oh, I'm going to find you. Shout out to Antoine Dodson. But so have you actually seen a tornado, and what was that experience like if you did?
I have seen them. I've seen the damage too, which varies. I'm not going to say it's like everyday life, because they don't happen every day. But it does happen like maybe every year. I mean, to me, it's kind of cool, depending on like the ones that we see aren't devastating and did nothing crazy. It's like, oh, there's a roof of someone's house. I don't know. So, I mean, it's interesting. I've always been interested in weather and stuff like that. Twister. I don't know if you guys remember that movie that came out in the 90s.
That's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, that was a horror movie for us, though. Like, I had dreams about that movie, like nightmares. So that's the difference. Like, it was a cool movie for everybody else. We're like, oh, hell no. Like, we know what this movie is.
You talked about the 3-day guide at Building Bread, but where can the people find you around the social medias?
Yeah, you can find me all over the internet at buildingbread.com. All of my social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, is all at Building Bread. And you'll see me and my face and all the other things I offer.
All right. Appreciate it, Kevin. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I feel like I'm ready to step out here and put my investment shoes on. Speaking of, I messed my shoes up out here in the rain, so I'm feeling some type of way. So, you know, that ain't got nothing to do with the show. I just really literally feeling some type of way about it right now. I'm looking at these shoes.
Your wet feet are the worst.
Yeah, man. So for those of you who follow me on the Snapchats, I found myself at the club, which is it's a rarity these days. It was an ACL.
At 35?
Yeah, Austin City Limits. You know, I figured I'd poke my head out there. And like, it poured, like the sky opened up, man. And like, these shoes, I mean, I got some life out of them, but I just got them, like, now ruined, soaked. I don't know what to do with them. I want to donate them, but like, I don't want to give them away on principle. So anyway, I'm still feeling some type of way about this. Ain't got nothing to do with the show, but it got everything to do with the show.
Nah, I totally understand, man. But definitely a great conversation with Kevin. Appreciate him coming on the podcast. And if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to share and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. If you don't know how, you can go to paychecksandbalances.com/review. And today's review of the week comes from Joe in Orlando. I'm not sure if I met this Joe or if I did while we were in Orlando. My apologies. Our apologies. I'm not sure if you remember this Joe from Orlando.
I do not remember Joe from Orlando. I do remember a Joe in Orlando, but that thing, pretty sure that's a different Joe.
Well, Joe, we appreciate it. And so this review, this show is changing my life, 5 stars.
I discovered this podcast from a friend retweeting something on Twitter. I started listening with the Debt-Free Period show, and it has helped me quite a bit in evaluating how to get myself out of the debt that 19 to 26-year-old Joe got himself into. Great work with the show, and thank you for all the sound advice you're giving out. So, Joe, again, appreciate those 5 stars.
Appreciate you, Joe, in Orlando. And Joe's all over America. And if you would also like to find us on social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with 1 T on Twitter and 2 Ts everywhere else on Earth. Rich is at I Am Rich Jones.
I am.
And as we mentioned up top, don't forget to join our email list by visiting paybal.co/email. We receive our weekly newsletter covering actual work and money tips and much more.
Again, we want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. We'll be back next week. Until then, be safe. We out. Peace.